Blog Talk Radio.
Here comes Santa Claus, here comes Santa Claus, right down Santa Claus Lane. Blixing and blixing and all his reindeers pulling on the reins. Bells are ringing, children singing, all is merry and bright. So hang your stockings and say your prayers, 'cause Santa Claus comes tonight. Here comes Santa Claus, here comes Santa Claus, right down Santa Claus Lane. He's got a bag that's filled with toys for boys and girls again.
Yeah, it's Santa Claus time.
Oh, what a beautiful sight.
Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Hope you're doing well.
Santa Claus comes tonight.
It's December 24th. It's the day before Christmas. Some of you may be enjoying Christmas as we speak, opening all the gifts and stuff. It's a fun time of year. Lots of things to do, hanging out with family. Sometimes that's not the greatest thing to do, but we all put up with it and hang out with the folks and the family. So Merry Christmas. Hope you're doing well. Yeah, that's Gene Autry. I love Gene Autry. He was the singing cowboy. That was recorded in 1947. And, man, those were the bygone years when everybody got into the act. And that's a classic song. So, Gene Autry. Hey, Earth Ancients is brought to you by Gaia. And this month and into the new year, you can access over 7,000 titles, original movies, streaming media, for just 99 cents. And they're promoting a new Greg Braden series called Missing Link. And I asked Greg about this, and he sent me a description. I'm going to read it. Here it is right here. We're living in a time of extremes. We have reached a point where unsustainable ways of living have caught up with us. In order to thrive in the world emerging before our lives, we need to embrace a new way of thinking. New discoveries reveal our relationship to our ancient past and may hold the keys to the way we think about ourselves, one another, and our world. Explore the deep truths of our origins, history, destiny, and fate with Missing Links. Now, I haven't seen any part of this new series, but has to do with a lot of his new discoveries. He's discovered techniques that revitalize us. And I don't know if they're meditative or yoga-like, body movements or whatever, but it's definitely something to check out. And the only way you're going to be able to see this new series, Missing Links, is to join Earth Ancients, or excuse me, to join the series Missing Link. And for 99 cents, you can go to Gaia.com/Earth Ancients and check it out. And there's a whole page that's been designed for you, the listener of Earth Ancients, to check out. There's a whole bunch of series on Graham Hancock. There's a pyramid series by Dave Wilcox. That's pretty cool, actually. It's a 4-part series. So check it out and get into it. Hey, 99 cents for the first month, kind of a gift to yourself into the new year. And hey, if you don't like it, jump off. You don't need it if you don't feel you need it, but I think you will. I think you'll like it. Hey, check out the Earth Ancients page. Earth Ancients, it's on Facebook. Go to groups. And there's a Roman amphitheater in Turkey that someone used one of these 360-degree cameras on. It's like you're right there. And it's a huge facility in Turkey. And the camera pans in a 360-degree focus. So you see the top, the bottom, the details of this massive, massive structure. Probably was seating for about, I want to say, at least 10,000 people, maybe more. And you can see it on Earth Ancients Facebook. Go to the group page and check it out. And, you know, always hang out there a little bit. Scroll down and see some of the other features, some of the other information, because that's where it goes. I don't have the space on the earthancients.com page to put this. So Facebook is a great way to access it. You know, you gotta, if you're not a Facebook person, you just log on, you know, put yourself together, get a photograph of yourself, and then just jump on Earth Ancients. You don't need to worry about what your, you know, what your personal page is. Just jump on there and check it out and see what's going on with the world of Earth Ancients. Which reminds me, Path of the Sacred Maya, April 2nd through the 8th, 2017. You know, it's a great gift to yourself in the new year. We're going to be touring Yucatan with the Mayan shaman, Miguel Angel. And if you want to see the whole itinerary, go to earthancients.com and you can catch the start to finish. We land in Mérida. I think our first stop is Ekbalam with those amazing sculptures. There's a sculpture of a long head. I think a number of other very unusual sculptures are there. An oval structure that is just amazing. They still don't know why the Maya would build their buildings with ovals. There must be something about it. Balam is just one of the five sites we'll be visiting during that one-week trip, Path of the Sacred Maya. We'll be in Mayapan, which is a pyramid you can climb. The Great Chichen Itza, which is considered a Mayan university. We'll hang out there. Coba. And then my favorite Mayan site is Uxmal. We'll be there for the whole day. And, you know, you don't have to hang with us. You can walk off and do your own thing. You know, just hang with us for a little bit in the beginning. And these places are huge. So, I mean, it's like they're like parks, massive parks. So, hey, and we've made it cheap, too. We're knocking off $600 to join. And to join, just go to earthancients.com, and you'll see the banner, Path of the Sacred Maya. And just click it, and you'll see the entire itinerary. Get your deposit in there. We only got space for another 10 people, and we're only going to take 20. So it's going to be a real intimate group. We're going to have a blast. So Path of the Sacred Maya, April 2nd through the 8th. I hope you can join me. That reminds me, sign up. And to know more about Earth Ancients, sign up, go to the Earth Ancients page, you scroll to the very bottom, and there's the registration page. And when you sign up, you get the newsletter. I'm just finishing up today on the newsletter. I'll be sending it out this afternoon. And I'm going to give away another ebook, and I haven't, I'm going to announce it later, but I'll announce it later. But if the only way you're going to get that ebook is by joining earthancients.com. It has all the details of upcoming programs, interesting bits and pieces of information, and all things Earth Ancients. So definitely check it out.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
And because we're at the end of the year, we're going to do the top five archaeological discoveries in America in 2016. And this is comprised of a different parts of the Western U.S., and it's from Western Digs, which is an archaeological magazine, and their archaeologists have put together this list. And I'm going to read them off, starting with top five, and this is number five, rock art and solar calendar recorded in Arizona. This is a site that's 4,000 years old, and they found a number of calendars. This is just discovered. I guess west of Tempe. And you can, by the way, I'm going to post this on the Earth Ancients page, Earth Ancients, go to Facebook, Earth Ancients, go to group and you'll see the top five. So rock art, solar calendar was number five. Number four is 12,000-year-old tool-making site discovered in California's Channel Islands. Now, we talked about the Channel Islands. There was a mastodon found there, a small elephant, and they kept digging, and they found a ton of these tools, and most of them are 12,000 years or older. It's from a paleo-coastal culture. They don't really know. They think they were seafaring people. And that's so long ago, that island may have been attached to California. They're not quite sure. So that's number four. Number three, oldest human footprint in Southwest uncovered in Tucson, another Tucson, Arizona footprint. And this footprint is 2,500 years old. And that's number three. Number two, stash of obsidian blades hidden for 1,000 years discovered in Oregon, of all places. And you can read about that too. Blades, and they're made from obsidian glass in Oregon. That's kind of cool. And then the number one discovery in Western United States in 2016 is 16,000-year-old tools discovered in Texas. And these are believed to be a cliff site. And they have, there's a burial there, there's fragments of human teeth. 90 stone tools were discovered, and their structures were discovered in a nearby area. So those are the top five discoveries in the Western United States, which I thought were kind of interesting. Love to find a solar calendar like a Stonehenge in the U.S. I think they're going to eventually find something like that. There's so many open areas that we just don't know about waiting to be discovered. So very cool. Okay, so today my guest is Ashley Cowie, and this is Quest for the Inca Gold Sun Disc. And it's funny, Ashley posted the first of a four-part blog on his travels, and I said, "Hey, Ashley, let's get you on the program and talk about this discovery." And fascinating, I think you're going to like this. I'll come back at the end, and we'll talk about the next program after it's over. So we've discussed Peru a number of times. We've had a number of authors on the program, and research investigators. I'm fascinated with Peru, and as you listeners know, whenever I get a chance to post something on our Facebook page about Peru, I do it, because not only is the stonemasonry amazing, a lot of it's undateable, but it's extremely sophisticated in a number of areas. And one of the real focal points of Peru is Cusco. And I'm always looking for interesting bits and pieces of information. And our guest today sent an article in on his research, and I had to have him on. And the piece that you'll see on the Facebook page is Quest for the Golden Sun Disc. And my guest today is Ashley Cowie, and he is a writer, explorer, and a research investigator. He's been on a number of television programs. His Legend Quest series was filmed in 40 different countries, and in that series he's searching for lost artifacts and treasures. And boy, I'm going to have to look that one up, because that sounds fun. Just totally cool. Ashley, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Cliff.
So what got you interested in, see, you're from Scotland. What got you interested to come out to the Peru? I mean, you know, there's stories of the conquistadors coming out to pillage Peru, and specifically Cusco. But what was the starting point for you?
I am, you're right. A small fishing village in the north of Scotland was where I was brought up. But as remote as it was, by the time I got to 17, 18, I realized I wasn't actually remote. I just needed to change the way I saw these landscapes. I was brought up in one of the oldest landscapes in the world. We have Mesolithic and Neolithic buildings and burial monuments, cairns, which are dating back to some of them 3,000, 4,000 BC. So I was involved in ancient landscapes, fly fishing for all of my teens, all of my 20s. But here's the thing with Peru. Ancient stones, ancient buildings, especially the astronomical aspect, fascinated me. But every time I watched these Graham Hancock documentaries and Fingerprints of the Gods and whatnot, South America truly intimidated me. It was such a world away from the north of Scotland. And I kind of sensed in my early 30s that for me to even start to understand the Peruvian cultures, it would take an entire consciousness shift, a whole paradigm shift for me. And that intimidated me. It scared me. And to be honest, I just didn't think I would have the time to learn what I knew about the Scottish prehistory to do the same with Peruvian. And it's taken me 15 years to get the right mindset to be able to interpret their landscapes the way that I can do with Scotland. Mm-hmm. Good 15 years.
Yeah. Now, you're not you are focused on ancient ceremony. You're aren't you part of the Scottish Knights of Templar? You're part of the charter there, aren't you?
Yeah, I was 24 years old and I came up with some pretty, what we say, dynamic research on the several buildings in Europe. And I got invested as a member of the Knights Templar at 24. And then by 28, I became a knight officer in the Scottish Order. So that was, you know, the Knights Templar bring an awful lot of myth. The truth is, it was a Scottish history research organization with a bunch of like-minded guys who shared the same information, knowledge, research. But to the outside world, we had the Holy Grail and the secrets of the cosmos, right?
Right, yeah. Very cool. Okay, well, let's get right into it. This Golden Sun disk, what was the tipping point? Had you been doing research that would bring you to South America? Sun disk something that you read about in your research, and you decided you just had to get out to South America?
Yeah, I was one of these guys in my 20s where I was obsessed with the Indiana Jones culture, that whole search and discover thing, and I kind of associated the ancient world. The thing is, in Scotland, there's not very many ruins. We've got ruins, but we don't have ancient buildings. Whereas in Peru, you've still got monuments that are thousands of years old. So South America was like always I was always fascinated by it. But it was when I was in my mid-20s, I started doing TV shows in Scotland. And out of the blue, one evening, my flat in Glasgow, a producer from Los Angeles phoned me talking about this show they were doing, Legend Quest, and we're going to looking for an archaeologist to go around the world. So they asked me to write up 8 or 12 episodes. So during my research for Legend Quest, I came across the Golden Sun Disk in Peru. And above all of the other ancient artifacts that exist, that are out there, the Sun Disk has more layers of meaning that have actually been solved and understood. There's more layers in that onion than any other artifact I've come across in the world globally. That one artifact is like a page that describes an entire cosmovision of an entire nation, a continent. Can be data about their world beliefs and their universal beliefs can be extrapolated from one artifact by reading it, by simply looking at it. So, of course, it completely entrapped me. And when I got an opportunity funded to go put a 40-man expedition into wherever I wanted in Peru to find that thing, it was like every boy's dream come true. Can you imagine?
Yeah, totally cool. And you were funded, too. That's what really makes it amazing. So you can mount out an expedition. I want to let our audience know that Ashley's written a four-part article about this expedition he took up. It's on his website, ashleycowie.com, but it's also on my Facebook page. I think you posted the first of a series of four, and I'll go ahead and post the other three just for those of you who don't want to go to... I would suggest going to Ashley's website just for the heck of it, but I'll have it on my Facebook page too, which is very well written, very detailed, and quite an adventure we're going to be talking about. I want you to describe this god known as Viracocha and why he is such a key figure in this discovery of this sun disk.
Yeah, well, before I talk about Viracocha, to put us in the right mindset to understand Viracocha, mm-hmm. we have to consciously step away from our Western cosmology. We're all brought up with two options. There's two categories for us. One is religion, one is science. Do you know, in the Andes, in Peru, there is not a word for religion and there's not a word for science. Those concepts did not exist. So let's forget about our one creator who stands out with creation that we have to worship through fear, and he's not surrounded by a pantheon of gods and goddesses. And he was in our image. That is not the case for the creator god of Peru, Viracocha. Viracocha was a very human being. Before I go into what he actually was, let me tell you what he was described as, which actually helped me a lot. Viracocha is described as a tall, skinny, fair-haired, bearded white man in Peru. Would you believe it?
Yeah.
Now, when I turned up there, 6 foot one, 170 pounds with my staff, they gave me a second look, and they were super, super helpful. Just
hilarious.
In case. I mean, we're in rural Peru, and the skinny Scottish bearded guy turns up. However, so Viracocha is very often confused with the sun god. Well, the Peruvian sun god was called Inti. He was created by Viracocha. Viracocha is a concept. What Viracocha represents is the point of creation, the zero point. The Greeks would call it the monad, the point from which everything arose. The zero, and from it came the one. So Viracocha resides at the center of the Milky Way in the galaxy to the Incas. That's where he resides today. When he created the Earth, he was said to have done so from an island on Lake Titicaca in southern Peru, modern-day Bolivia.
Hmm.
Now, Viracocha first created the islands on Lake Titicaca. Then he created the moon and the sun, and the planets. Then he created humans. Now, he had three attempts at humans. The first set of humans Viracocha made were made of clay, and they were giants. Now, those clay giants didn't have brains, so they were kind of unruly, so Viracocha had to scrap that idea. He caused a flood. Two giants remained and turned into stone. Those two stones on the island of the sun on Lake Titicaca, at the point of creation, are those stones upon which all of the solar measurements at the Key Sun Temple on the island of the sun were taken. So Viracocha today can still be seen on the June and the December solstice risings as shadows cast from these two giants that have been turned into stone. So Viracocha, albeit a concept, was taken as true as a part of life as a tree or a river, mm-hmm. or as your food and your plate or as your children. He was a living, breathing entity that was in every living thing. Now, the universe that Viracocha created, the way the Incas viewed the universe, was him at the center. Cusco became the navel of the universe. Mm-hmm. It was the point they believed Viracocha created as after creation itself. Cusco, the center of the universe. But the Andeans, and this spreads right throughout the Andeans, it's not just the Incas, you find it all the way up to Colombia. Our universe is a linear universe with three dimensions, forward, backwards, and time.
Mm.
The X, Y, Z axis plus time. To the Incas, it was an infinite three-dimensional universe, but where ours is scientific-based and cause makes effect, for an effect to happen, a cause must be there. Not with the Incas. The Incas saw a living, breathing matrix, if you like, is the best way to describe it. A cube, a cosmic cube, where every created form in the universe was a filament. And where filaments gathered, sorry, they were called nodes. And where you got a gathering of nodes, that was called a filament, an object. That could be your fingernail, a tree, a cloud, a cow. So they saw gatherings of filaments. And where these filaments gathered greatest, where the shamans saw the filaments gathering greatest, the conduits with the creator, the shamans, those became hoikas, sacred sites on the landscape. Now, the hoika system of Peru, sacred shrines, now we can come back to this and go into hoikas in detail, but a hoika could be, it's a node on the landscape, a gathering of filaments, if you like, where the cosmic energy of the universe, Viracocha's breath, is said to be present at all times. Now, these hoikas were local shrines, rocks, mounds, cliffs, curves in rivers. They were but they were enhanced and carved upon by the Incas to enhance the energy they believed was flowing. Mm-hmm. Now, in the Coracancha temple, the temple of the sun, at the center of that temple converged 41 keek lines, which we would call ley lines.
Mm-hmm.
Those energy lines emitted to and from the temple, 328 of them, one for every one of their lunar months. So what you have are keek lines stemming from their central temple, the point of creation, 328 of them extending across the entire empire. They were the hoikas upon these lines, the energy, the battery points, if you like, the battery packs for this flowing system of energy to and from the Cuzco temple, was managed and maintained by local, what you would call keek manageresses, the eldest women of the tribes of the local farms, used to give offerings, pay worship, and also organize the rituals that happened at certain solar times, in certain astronomical conditions, agricultural moments, festivals, rituals. So they had a system on the earth of lines which they believed flowed with energy, as does the universe. Local hoikas on these lines, nodes, as is the universe made up from, and controlling the whole system was Viracocha, the creator. But he didn't stand out with the system like our God. He is the system.
Let me talk a little more about Viracocha, because he's quite an interesting figure. In your research, and a lot of other research investigators think this, that he actually came from another place. And he actually was a physical human being who may have been extremely advanced in the sciences and in astronomy and things like that. What is your belief based on some of the other people's understandings of Viracocha? Do you believe that he actually came from perhaps Mu, or which is present-day the island out in the middle of the Pacific? Do you think it's a complete myth? What's your true feeling about this god?
Yeah, that really is a good one. That's a great question. And the reason I say it's great is because the reason I'm writing these articles now is because it's only now that these things make sense to me. Now, I think Viracocha, to answer your question, Viracocha is the summary of ancient knowledge that was not accessible by the masses, the knowledge that was the reserves of the ancient priesthoods through time. And what I'm talking about are the people who were the keepers of geometry, mathematics, arithmetic, chemistry, mixing plants, seeds, predicting floods, seasonal change. They had to know the systems of universal scale, proportion, ratio, and time. Now, the masses, 99% of the people are illiterate. They can't even speak properly and write. They do through symbols and through gestures. We're talking prehistory here. Mm-hmm. But the people who were able to measure massive distances over landscapes, two stars arising, these systems of what we would call sciences, but knowledge of how to do such things, I think, is summarized by Viracocha. But I must say this, Viracocha as an entity was, I mean, the Tiwanaku, the people that the Inca came from, mm-hmm. worshipped an entity very similar to Viracocha. Now, I can tell you this, the sun god of the Titinacu in southern Lake Titicaca, their sun god became Viracocha of the Incas.
Hmm.
Viracocha evolved from the sun god. But they were present 2,000 years prior to the Incas. So we could have Viracocha, or the entity, the person, the concept, going as far back as 2000 BC, at least.
Right.
Now, what I find super interesting to support my argument that he is the god or the representation of measuring, mathematics, astronomy, geometry, is this. The one carving we have of Viracocha, which is on the gate of the sun at Lake Titicaca, shows a man with 24 rays of light emitting from his head,
mm-hmm.
the solar calendar, but he's holding two staffs. Now, traditional classic archaeologists interpret Viracocha's two staffs as representing either the sun or the moon, or thunder and lightning. I believe those staffs represent the Dodd staffs of a surveyor, the Dodd staffs of a man who is measuring an alignment on a landscape around which all of the calendars, all of the ritual systems, all of the celebrations could be, the whole cosmology could be built upon. I think he was the creator of the alignment, which we'll get to later in the interview.
Okay. Well, this is interesting that you say that, because Kukulcan Khan in Central America was the deliverer of information to the natives, which eventually became the Maya, and also in the Teotihuacan area, is said to have maybe migrated from the great island Mu in the Pacific. So Viracocha may have been another one of these extremely brilliant people who came to reset civilization after the great deluge. And this is what I'm curious about, what you've discovered, because it seems like the idea behind Viracocha is a very advanced person who is a conveyor of information, sciences, knowledge, writing, mathematics, so on and so forth. And he's disseminating information thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago, over 10,000 years ago. Who knows how long ago it was, when something disastrous happened to our planet. So so it's just very curious to hear about this the activities of this individual or god or whatever you want to call him. I just find it quite interesting.
I think you're okay, so there's two ways of looking at this. There's two ways. Let's go straight archaeology, then let's go off the wall, okay? If my theory stands, which is he was a master of measurement, a master of creation, if you like, he came from the sun god of the people who inhabited the Peru pre-Inca. Mm-hmm. Now, let's look at Mu. Let's go back into prehistory and assume and accept for a second that a lost continent existed, a continent that had achieved high technology. The trouble I have with linking Viracocha to coming from such a thing is, and you're going to hate me for this, but I need somebody to slide onto my table that hard evidence off that island of Mu. Give me that one chink. And with that, I can give you the journey of Viracocha from about 12,000 BC. Mm-hmm. But I need Mu. Like you need Mu. Like we all need Mu.
Yeah. There's a book that just came out. We just had Dr. Susan Martinez come on. She wrote a book called the Sacred Island of Pan. And Pan is Mu, which is Mu is Lemuria. She doesn't like to use the word Lemuria. But she actually has quite systematically listed a lot of information that relates to this island from what she knows, what she discovered in Mexico, South America, and in North America. So it's slowly coming to light, more and more evidence. I think what you're saying is, hey, there's nothing physically left here that we know about. Other than perhaps Easter Island and some of the surrounding islands that have strange figures on them, but it's a I understand from a academic point of view, it's like, hey, there's no proof. How can you say there was a moo?
Well, yeah, but I think, you know, I try to take so what I discover is based in the real world and not in fantasy world, and what I want to be true. I do try to stick to only base your beliefs on that which can be tested, proved, and you have evidence for. But also, I'm not an idiot. I've got an emotional side. I can speculate like anyone else freely, and I can say this. People were in South America since 12,000 BC. Mm. I bet my bottom dollar there were a number of islands that were inhabited that had sunk, that had been flooded, that have collapsed through earthquake and volcano. This isn't a cray-cray concept, the idea that the lost civilizations. There's been many. We've been here for 4 million years. There's been more people have died. I mean, come on, there's been lost civilizations. The trouble is, the whole concept is surrounded by pseudoscience and surrounded by sci-fi now.
Yeah.
Where we can't just find a lost continent of human beings that achieved high technology in the sense of measuring skills, astronomy, observation, the things that really built the modern world. What we're trying to do is find stargates and landing pads, and it screws the whole thing up.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Exactly. I will say this, though. There is a lot of interesting artifacts in Bolivia that show very unusual humans. In fact, human skulls of beings that were very big, had elongated craniums, and had heavy jaws, unlike any species we know today. So it looks like there's been a number of different humanoid types that have come and gone, perhaps as the Earth's gravitational field has changed and things like that. So there is some proof of unusual beings with very big heads, which means they had a very big brain, who could have been from a civilization that were big builders. We don't know.
I think you can't deny it. You know, one can argue what you've just said. I mean, the discovery of the Flores people on the Philippines Island, those miniature people, you know, I mean, that is a race of humanoid that we did not know existed until the last several decades. And also, we know there was 11 stand-up humans, Homo sapien. We won the war. We beat off the last of the Neanderthals some 20,000 years ago. We won the war. But yes, in the people digging up skeletons 4,000 years ago and finding prehistoric humanoids, these things are going to be interpreted as gods, and they certainly will appear in symbolism, and they will appear in statues. But I will say this as well, you've got to balance and be careful when you interpret these things, because they were big stylization, okay? I'm living in Colombia right now, studying the Muisca culture. I've recently been to the Gold Museum in Bogota.
Oh, wow.
There is, you could go in there. No, I did. I interviewed someone in there, and this is the thing. They came up with the same thing. They said, look at the shape of these humans. These humans have got wings. These humans are half animal. And I'm like, yeah, but look at the shape of the lizards and the birds and the snakes. They look like humans. They've been stylized. They were big into stylizing humans and animals. So, but that doesn't mean that they were also not part and parcel to pre-civilizations and lost civilizations.
Yeah.
We are such a narcissistic species that we have destroyed more cultures and more peoples in genocidal acts than I just care to think about. It's quite shocking.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. That Gold Museum is very famous for a number of very interesting, very old artifacts, and they're small-shaped jewelry in the shape of airplanes and rockets.
I can't believe now. So I wrote a blog article 7 weeks ago, which I'm going to plug it blatantly. You need to read it. It's ashleycowie.com blog. It's an article about the Tolima airplanes.
Yeah.
The very artifacts. Now, I got the very good experience of interviewing the curator at the museum about these airplanes, and I've done a complete study on them. I've presented them as stylized insects, lizards, snakes, and I've related it to a part of a shamanic ritual where they went through the most important part, which was transmutation from human to animal. So that's what I reckon these are. However, You're going to tell me 1964, a guy built them as balsa wood airplanes in Germany, and every one of them flew perfectly.
Right.
Then I'm going to say to you, yeah, perfectly, but they had to add engines and propellers and flaps. So, round the circle we will go.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. I'll have to have you back on to talk about those, because they're engineered or structurally very similar to planes. But that we digress there. Listen, let's get back to Viracocha. Is it believed that he created the Golden Sun disc? It was his hand that created it?
Yes, Viracocha brought with him the Golden Sun disc. Because what happened was, let's get back to Viracocha. So Viracocha creates the heavens and the earth. Then he creates the humans, as I say, the giants were the first run. He balls that up, destroyed them. Then he created us. He got down to us after a couple of prototypes. Then he set about walking. He journeyed the length of Peru, spreading knowledge of the arts, civilization, the arts, and culture.
Mm.
And that's exactly where my research keyed into. This concept of Viracocha creating everything and then journeying across Peru, where he ended up at the Pacific Ocean and set sail west, where he promised to return once again to Lake Titicaca when we needed him most, to the point of creation.
Okay.
Well, that's where I got to thinking, let's have a look, let's plot, let's map Viracocha's journey to the northwest, across Peru, to the Pacific Ocean. And that's where the whole kind of penultimate blog article comes from, where if you draw a line to match the June solstice sunrise at Lake Titicaca, you're going to find it rises at 65 degrees east of north. That sun sets on the June solstice at 295 degrees.
Yeah.
Now, every calendar, ritual, civic, ceremonial, agricultural, were set and calibrated on the setting of the June solstice sun. Viracocha traveled to the northwest, following the path of the June solstice sunset, 295 degrees. When I drew that line in, from Lake Titicaca, island of the sun, center of the temple of the sun, I drew it to the Pacific Ocean, and it arrives at the coast 15 miles south of Lima, 600 miles northwest, where Viracocha landed, at the second most important sun temple in the Inca Empire, Pachacamac. And Pachacamac, I'm going to take the liberty here at going into that off the wall, out there place. Pachacamac is one of the four temples in the world that NASA have accepted and identified as emitting a really curious magnetic anomaly. They measure extremely unpredictable magnetic occurrences at Pachacamac.
Let me stop you real quickly. Where is it located? What part of...
15 miles south of Lima on the northwest coast of Peru.
Northwest
where Viracocha sets sail.
Okay.
So basically what you've got is Viracocha with his two staffs. He establishes a temple in the south at Lake Titicaca.
Yeah.
And at the other end of the June solstice line, boom, you've got a second sun temple. Now, here you go. Viracocha was he's the first temple, the creator of the world. Guess what Pachacamac is? Pachacamac, Pacha means world, Camac means activator. Pachacamac is the activator of the world.
Mm.
So the June solstice sun line scratched across the landscape of Peru. The Incas was the Inca spine. It was their fulcrum. It was their axis mundi upon which every calendar, ritual, and ceremonial system was revolved.
Mm-hmm.
That is Viracocha. He is the sun cycle, the sun system over the course of a year. Because that's what they depended on to survive. The sun didn't show if climate changed, if the clouds were unpredictable for a season. It could mean the loss of hundreds of thousands of people through starvation and famine. They were completely at the beck and call of two entities, the sun and the moon, both who play an effect on Earth. Venus shines its light every 5 or 6 years, and we get the steely, ghostly light of Venus, but that is the only other planet that has a direct effect on Earth. We could go into astrology if you want, but that's for another place at another time.
Yeah.
The moon and the sun and what they do affect your direct survival and the survival of your children. Can I feed my kids tomorrow? Now, those got ritualized big time over time. You needed those to come back in the morning. You saw them disappearing at night. And in a way that we will never understand, a kind of state of terror came with the night because they didn't know the sun was going to come back. They saw it coming back, but they thought that's because we are doing the rituals that our grandparents did. My God, we're not going to stop those. And they built upon them to make sure the sun and the moon didn't wobble.
Fascinating. You write a great series of blogs, these four blogs on this search for the golden sun disc. And it's interesting because you describe the conquistador Francisco Pizarro coming and arriving in Peru and then going to Cusco. How did they, and you describe the disc being removed. Why would they remove the disc? Was it the fact that it was so sacred they needed to get it out of the heart of the Inca capital to save it? Or did they know ahead of time that Pizarro was there just for gold and that he would probably melt the thing down?
No, that's a great one again. So what you've done is you've brought me back to where we were 20 minutes ago when you asked me, when I was describing the Cusco, the Temple of the Sun in Cusco was the navel of the universe.
Right.
This is the thing. The golden sun disc was at the center of the temple, at the navel of the universe. Do you know what? The golden sun disc, it was this, the navel of the navel of the navel of the universe, the God button, if you like. It's the God button. Now, the golden sun disc is located at the center of the temple. The 41 keek lines, energy lines, stemming from the Inca Empire to the center of the sun disc. Seven priests monitored the lines, the energy flows coming in and out of the temple in states of 24/7, 365 meditation. They believed they could feel and gauge the spiritual climate of the people on the different energy lines, but they also believed they could manipulate it and generate energy outwards into the landscapes, altering the humidity and climate, the thinking processes of people. If they had just suffered a war or an invasion, they believed they could control climate, the reality, if you like, using the sun disc. Now, Pizarro rocks up. What are they know these men have one thing and one thing on their mind, and that is the gold.
Right.
They've seen them do deals with other townships. They've been trading and buying gold. To be honest with you, gold was mixed so heavily with copper that it's not actually as valuable as everybody thinks it is, right? You wouldn't believe how low the actual treasure museum in Lima is insured at because it's mostly copper. However, the golden sun disc was the central artifact in their central sun temple at the navel of their universe. They needed to use that sun disc to found the next Inca temple because Emperor Pachacuti predicted the arrival, believe it or not, of the Spaniards. He predicted the arrival of a poisonous race of white men. He died 3 months later. My goodness, they arrived all right. So the disc was taken north to the Vilcabamba region where it was used to found the next city of the Incas, Viscos and Vilcabamba, the two cities. So Manco Inca, the Inca who was the ruler when Francisco Pizarro turned up in 1537, if I get it right. However, Manco Inca fled with the disc, went to Sacsayhuaman above Peru, above Cusco, and continued on the north alignment, and he got there. He founded the Vilcabamba and took refuge in the highest building in the Neo-Inca Empire. It's called Inca Wasi. Now, we ventured there 14,000 feet looking for that disc.
Mm.
And I can't even start to tell you what I saw, how I changed and personally evolved, having spent 2 weeks on horses going to 14,000 feet, being eaten alive by weather fronts that I couldn't even dream of having. Just Viracocha spitting on us. And we got higher and higher and higher and got to Inca Wasi. And it was there, an accumulation of 15 years. The sun disc as a physical object became secondary to me. I started to see with true Inca cosmovision. I allowed myself at Inca Wasi to sit on a viewing platform, an astronomical viewing platform. I looked out, and to the east, In front of me was a basin, a man-made carved basin, and in it was the reflection of a rock, the Oracle Rock of Incahuasi. I saw the male phallic Oracle Rock penetrate the female basin of water, and in front of me, I saw the Viracocha myth re-transplanted into the landscape, the idea of a male entity rising from female waters, Viracocha rising from Titicaca. And I started to see the entire Inca landscape as Viracocha. Viracocha is in every Hoika sacred site. He's in every keek line, energy line. He's in every temple, every managed cliff top and that's been chipped away or flattened to enhance an astronomical occurrence to cast a shadow. Viracocha as a concept exists in every blade of grass in the managed Inca landscape. And I tasted that. So therefore, I can happily say, oh boy, did I discover the golden sun disk.
It's amazing, yeah. You know, you describe these keek lines, and you in your article you say 41 keek lines from the Temple of the Sun unifying 328 sacred sites across the Inca Empire.
Yeah.
Do we know each one of those sacred sites? I mean, are they known locations throughout Peru?
Oh my goodness, you are just like, you're reading my mind. So I needed to come back to this. So here we go. 41 keek lines, 328 sacred sites. Now listen, that was on the national keek system. Then you've got your localized one. They reckon there was over 1,000 keek lines at Hoikas when the Spaniards arrived. But listen to now, a man by the name of R. Thomas Zedema in 1950, he arrived in Cusco with a team of astronomers from European universities and measured, monitored, mapped every one of the 41 keek lines and the 328 Hoikas.
Wow.
Now, it was him that went, so why are there 328 Hoikas? Why not 327? Why not 329? And then he quickly calculated after three nights with three elder astronomers, or shamans, if you like, in the Sun Temple in Cusco, modern. They told him, well, the 328 Hoikas represent the 41 8-day weeks, 328 days, or 12 times their 27.5-day lunar months, 328 days in their lunar year. So the keek system of line alignments that blended and united the entire landscape, the Inca Empire, was based on their astronomical observations. So the Hoikas, the sacred sites that were placed on these energy lines, were enhanced for lunar observations, solar observations, funeral rites, ceremonial rites, when seeds were being planted, when animals were being fertilized. These key dates were all marked with shadow. And the keek management women, the elders who were actually doing the physical work on the keeks, packing them with mud to make a shadow cast more to the left or to the right. If a river changed its flow, the Hoika would need moved because the shadows needed moved to touch certain lips of rivers and basins and ponds. In 1950s, it was completely monitored, and it's not really been added to since. What's crying out to be done, and I reckon I could do it with a team of 10 or 15 over the course of 3 years, but it's going to take over $2 million. That would be to go to each of the 41 keep lines, to each of the 328 Hoikas, sacred site on the keep lines, and take full astronomical measurements from each one and build up the astronomical cosmic belief system behind the actual keeks and Hoikas that we know are there.
Okay.
So let's get into the true Inca cosmovision. Let's paint right now. Although we know there's 41 lines, we know there's 328 Hoikas. That's like a black and white kid's coloring in painting that's got no color on it. There's no depth. We don't know the exact astronomical conditions and alignments that this whole thing was built on, but we can sense it. We can touch it. We know it's there.
Amazing. Again, of the 328 sacred sites, have you located and kind of pinpointed one or two that are noted sacred sites, like, say, Sacsayhuaman or maybe some specific location in Peru or Bolivia or somewhere that we're real familiar with?
Yeah. The most important one is obviously Cusco, the Sun Temple in Cusco.
Yeah.
The second most important one in the Inca Empire was the White Rock Oracle. It's a massive 300-ton boulder in the Vilcabamba region, which is, I've covered that in the blogs there. It's like a kind of mechanical machine, if you like. It's like an industrial device. But again, this records all of their calendars, the Venetian calendar, the lunar calendar, the solar calendar, the rituals, the civic calendars. It's all there in one rock. Mm-hmm. But what are you looking for? Where the extent of the key clients go? Are you looking for... this is the thing. The Hoikas are, probably the most famous one would be Machu Picchu, right? The Temple of the Sun at Machu Picchu.
Right.
Okay, so here we go back to the idea that the Hoikas are nodes. Where nodes gather, you have filaments. Those become the temples, the central sun temples. The Temple of the Sun at Machu Picchu was... how do I describe it? It's kind of like the Mike Tysons of the Hoika world. It is just the king, and Machu Picchu collapsed before it stopped being, one of the main. And the reason for that was because of its astronomical conditions and its situation. It was believed to be what you would call a tholus point, a charging point, where the sun on its zenith on the June solstice, when it's tracking over the sky on the Viracocha day, I call it, was said when it cast no shadows. So those massive mountains you see at Machu Picchu, can you imagine when the sun's directly above at midday on the solstice? They cast no shadows. The sun was perceived as directly charging the batteries of the Hoika Keek system.
Wow.
From Machu Picchu, even though the golden sun disk was in controlling it with micro tweaks, spinning that, I call them like DJs of the sun, right? Spinning that wheel of steel. And they were doing that at Cusco. However, they were receiving energy from the sun at Machu Picchu, Temple of the Sun, and putting that out into the Keek system equal to what they were doing in Cusco.
Pretty amazing. Before we leave the Keek system, and you explain it fairly well, it's similar to our ley lines, which are kind of energetic fields, and you actually have a diagram that's probably old, someone put together years ago, which is a grid of the Earth. These ley lines are connecting major spots throughout our planet, and it's interesting to note that in some of the big connections where multiple ley lines connect into a central area, I think that's one of them is like Stonehenge and other key locations in the old world of Middle East, which is quite unique. But what I want to ask you is, how do you believe this golden sun disk unifies the Keek lines in Peru? If Cusco is the central location where this sun disk is located, is it like a emanating information? Is it controlling the flow of this pulse? I mean, it seems like it's some kind of a computer bank or something that drives the Keek line energies.
Yeah, it's okay. So here's where this is where the whole Peruvian Inca study, the whole world, anyone who's interested in these subjects, there's two factions form. This truly is science and religion, same kind of war. What you've got are the people who believe there was a kind of, let's just say, a lost energy in prehistory that did flow through our landscapes, the people and all living things within it, that did travel in straight alignments across the landscape, that did actually physically alter, that could make rocks weightless, that could, speed up transportation, all these, which you could almost label sci-fi systems. But then there's the other faction that believe this is to do with consciousness. The golden sun disk is at the center of the central temple. Now, say an area in southern Peru suffered flood. Say there was hundreds of people lost in a random winter flood. Now, the priests would tell the local priests in that area, we're going to tweak the sun disk and we're going to give you 3 years of good times. By 2 years from now, your crops are going to be double what they are. You're all going to have a little bit more money. Before 2 days had passed, everybody in that region had been told that the super priests, the conduits to the gods, were just about to give them a bunch of good luck. Now, can you imagine the psyche of 100,000 people in a region all being told you are being given good luck and fortune? That change of psyche, that change of attitude is enough to change reality and to bring about those expected changes. So were these priests, the high priests, controlling the psyche of the people through a very clever system, or were there lost energy lines? I go for the former, to be honest with you. And the reason for that is, again, we're a pretty advanced race. We can put rovers to Mars and feed back HD images. If there is an energy out there in the universe that is unknown, that's kind of like knock the world on its tip, the world on its head. I just don't see that coming. I think we know about all the forms of energy that are here. We have a pretty firm periodic table. We don't seem to be missing anything in physics. So I do think it's a case of they control the psyche of the populace by, because they all truly believed, like, this is the thing we can't understand. We have religious people today who believe in their God, and they faithfully go to church once or twice a week. And they have altars of their gods in their houses, and they're really nice, good moral people that follow the book of their gods. But they have a lot of time off, a lot of time off. We don't, the Incas don't. The Inca Cosmovision was a daily way of being, a way of looking, a way of thinking, of seeing. Everything was alive. Everything was a breathing entity. Everything was imbued with supernatural energy, as were humans. And I think it's very difficult for us to kind of see how the effects of a priesthood controlling a Keek system could work on a psychological level without being an Inca. But I think it was just knowing those guys in the top temple are looking after us. But in the same way, if a region didn't pay taxes or was found to be holding back on crop and selling it through the back door, you know, we are humans, they could then be told, you know something, dark times are going to come upon you. And priests can quite easily, I know this happened in Scottish history, to maintain supernatural power, they would say, okay, we're going to bring demons onto your crops. And 2 weeks later, there was a band of 40 guys paid to go to the top of the hill to pour phosphates into the water to kill the damn crops to retain the power of the priesthoods.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
So there's lots of ways of looking at that. But I think the way of doing it is for the people. If everybody believes something's happening, if everyone believes in something, whether it's a teapot going around the moon or whether it's a golden sun disk controlling the fate of the nation, if everybody believes in it, it might as well be real.
Interesting. Okay, let's talk about the journey to find this sun disk.
Yeah.
You're funded by, I guess, NBC to create the series,
yeah,
right? And you pulled together a team of 40 people, including Inca trailblazers, and you even had a medical person on there too. And you start your journey, and you're going higher and higher and higher. And then you write about your own ill health, unfortunately. Can you talk a little bit about what happened? I found that quite fascinating, and how they solved your critical metabolism issues.
That was critical. Right, so 8 years ago, on my birthday, I didn't waken up, and 2 days later was diagnosed as a type 1 diabetic. And for those that don't know what that is, basically, I don't regulate what I do with sugar. So if I don't get sugar, I can pass out into a coma. If I get too much sugar, I go into a dreamlike, hazy state, aggressive, angry. Some people get that way. I just get sort of lethargic, lazy, and dreamy. However, coma is the end result with too much or too little sugar. So we've got to 10,000 feet into the Peruvian Andes, and we're there for a week. And I had given the French fixers, we had 8 production fixers with us, making sure all of our stuff, like our food and our battery chargers and our tents, so there was making sure the Incas were going ahead and making sure we didn't have to set up tents when we arrived there. We had tons of camera equipment, lighting equipment. So we got to the morning before the climb to the summit, myself and a team of 8, we took off from the main part. We left, the horses couldn't come any further, so we left the Incas with the horses, and we took off to about 13,000 feet, pitched in for the night. And the next morning we got up at 6, and I needed about 600 or 800 grams of carbohydrates to make it through the climb to the summit, never mind get 9 hours back down to the base to the team.
Yeah.
I asked the French fixer for my carbs, and you know, we've got an expression in Scotland when you say someone's whole head fell out their own arsehole. I'm sure you know what that means. The blood stains on his face, he melted, he went away for a few minutes, came back, and he said, I've left all of the food 9 hours down the hill.
Now, what
do
the
you know
hell?
What?
How would he forget that, knowing that you had a critical situation?
We were screwed. We had been a week with no sleep. Altitude has been sick from
altitude
both ends.
Sickness,
We had a sound guy who gave in. He went back. I mean, we had to get another sound guy. It was just a nightmare. Everyone got broken. Nobody was prepared for the hype tank. Awasi, the most challenging thing we've ever done. It was ridiculous. We had mudslides. We had flash floods. We were completely done. He was distracted, forgot my food. And Cliff, the truth is, I was distanced from the group, sat, and I had a little man moment. I cried because I was going to die. I had an hour and a half left. And the base camp was 9 hours away. I would have been in a coma for 6.5 hours.
So your condition is pretty managed. In other words, you have to eat on a regular basis certain amount of carbs. You talk about this.
I have to calculate. Okay, so I have to, when I wake up in the morning, I check my blood sugar level. If you look at yours right now, you have, let's just for to make this clear, you've got 10 units of blood per 100 units, 10 units of sugar per 100 units of blood.
Yeah.
I don't have that. I can be super high one day. I could be super low the next. What I need to do is eat enough carbohydrates to match the energy that I am expending.
Right.
So if I get up just now to walk to the shop, it's 500 meters. I need to check my blood and maybe have a glass of orange juice or 20 or 30 grams of carbs. Or else by the time I get to the shop, I'm going to be like a car who's run out of fuel, run out of sugar. I'm going to stop and I'm going to fall over. So here I am at 13,500 feet. With no food, my metabolism's going like mental because I've been a week hiking.
Yeah.
And I went, and as I said, I accepted within an hour and a half I was going to die, and I kind of started to make peace with that. And I thought it was so abstract to think. I kept thinking, why is it it's only like hours since I get my first sniff of a Cosmovision and Ian understanding after 15 years, and I'm going to be dead at 45 minutes later. Viracocha has got a twisted side, I thought. So here I was, and we panicked. So Kinga Phillips, she's such a sweetheart. She went and she kind of tore the French fixer. I'm not going to go down that route. She ripped him up. He went and got 8 of the Inca guides, who I saw vanishing into the fog. They all went in different directions. And we were getting really upset by then. I mean, the camera guy was in. He was more upset than I was because we all knew we had no chocolate, we had no carbs left. And they had a dead Scots guy on their hands, and it was really brutal.
Yeah.
And then it happened. Then that moment happened where all of the ink started beetling back through the clouds, and they were smiling. There was like jubilations, and they came around me, and it was a bit weird. They got a bit close. You know, I've got that 12-inch man zone. Just keep the hell out of it.
Yeah.
And no. Rubbing up against me, and all their machilas, their handbags, were stuffed with like fire engine red peachu berries, bags of sugar, ancient Incan mountain berries.
Wow.
So I packed these into me and I was sorted. I might as well have had like a candy store with me. So it was like the most enlightening feeling of, I don't know, you kind of, right, I'm a scientific sort of guy. But when moments like that happen, it makes you look up. It just does. You can't help it. These things are more powerful. My life got saved through ancient Inca's knowledge of landscapes at 13,500 feet, 4,000 feet beyond the clouds. They were able to save a diabetic's life.
Yeah.
And what I think was, I bet you if I had said, you know what, I'm epileptic and I've had an epileptic shot, I bet they would have gone and got me a root or a piece of grass or something to suck on that would have fixed that too.
Would have done that, yeah. So did you were you able to survive until you got back down to base camp? That was it, right?
No, I died about 2 hours later, Cliff. No, so yeah.
So you had a near-death experience and you're here to talk about it.
Hey, we haven't got to the end of the story yet. You're talking to Viracocha here. No. So I did. I got to Incahuasi, and we spent the day. Incahuasi is like regarded as an agricultural house. And I went there, and we noted 18 observations that establish it as not just a place of ritual and ceremony, but it's kind of like the most important sun temple in the Neo-Inca Empire. When Manco Inca retreated from the wars of Cusco, he went and stayed there. He brought his disc there. I'm convinced of it. And it's a three-floored sun temple with a managed landscape around it. You can see for 60 miles to the south. You can see 30 to the east. It's the most incredible place in the world. And what's amazing, it looks like an old farmer's croft. It doesn't look as if it's up to much. But if you've got the eye to see and see what it's, how it's situated in the landscape and what they've done to the landscape, it, there's just this ridiculous level of landscape engineering where they've flattened entire mountaintops to enhance astronomical observation. And Manco Inca retreated there, as I say, and he was the guy that was said to have taken the disc from Cusco. Where else would he have taken it apart from the highest solar temple in the new Inca Empire?
Yeah. This Inca Huasi you talk about, and you actually have some very interesting photos. It has similar design and architecture to Machu Picchu, to my mind, just the way the walls are. But what did you end up finding there, other than positioning for astronomical observation?
Yeah, so on the venture up in the last 100 or 300 meters, we discovered basins which had been cut into the bedrock, filled with water. Now, we couldn't see what those were from the basin, but once we got up to Inca Huasi, we could see that these were pools of reflection, is the direct translation, whereby astronomers could look down into pools of water and be able to monitor the transit of stars using the edges of the pools. They could monitor the time it took for stars to pass a given distance. So we were kind of all caught up in this astronomy thing. Then we found a bunch of Inca pins, stone pins beside these basins. Whatever they were going to be used for, we don't know. But when we got to the Inca Huasi, I positioned myself in the doorway, which is the viewing platform, if you like. And I was taken in the Cosmo Vision, making sense of all of the landscape features. We filmed the last section of the documentary, and I went down to the chamber beneath Inca Huasi for a little prod around. And I walked in the door, and I looked up, and I could see the doorway on the second floor where I was sitting, taking in the world, if you like. And I realized that I was now directly below that doorway, the most sacred part of the whole of the Finio Inca Empire. And beneath my feet was a gaping, deep, one-meter pit with fresh mud and rocks. Somebody, within 48 hours of our arrival at Inca Huasi, and I know this is going to sound like a kid with a fantasy tale, somebody within 48 hours of our arrival dug a meter pit, 2 meters wide, in the most holy part of the Temple of the Sun. I can only guess, Cliff, and we all sort of concluded this, that our voyage, this, you can imagine, a 40-man team in Vilcabamba in Peru has got quite a heat. It attracts attention, if you like.
Yeah.
We think someone got there before us and figured it, checked out the most holy part. If this is the Sun Temple and the disc is here, are we going to let a NBC film team take that away? Or are we going to have a little look ourselves? And I think some of these Inca guides that took us up had a look before we arrived. However, let's not get downhearted, because I had myself a dig. And I did find something, and you're going to hate me for this, but that's next week's blog article.
Ah, okay.
And it truly is, Keith. If you read the last paragraph of my fourth article, it says about the pit, I discovered the pit, I dug, what I found in there brought all of these things I've just told you about, the golden sun disk being to do with cosmology and astronomy and geometry, it brings it into the real physical 3D world. And I'm going to tell you now, a physical golden sun disk existed. I can tell you that for a fact, and I'm going to get into that stuff in the next couple of articles. But there's a golden sun disk for sure. Hey. And I'm going to be brave enough by the middle to the end of January of popping a location. I'm actually going to be brave enough to give a GPS location for where I think today, if someone was to invest it, not very much, probably the Peruvian authorities, I'll go there first. They'll be the right thing to do. But I'm going to give a location and a very good reason why.
We'll have to do a check-in with Ashley on one of our future shows just to hear what you're up to, which is fun. You do have a reproduction that you show on your blog of one of these shields. Is this
Are you talking about the gold map with the figures?
Yeah, the map. What is that? What is that all about?
Yeah, okay, so I skipped that earlier. I'll give it to you in a nutshell. It's called Pachacuti's map. Pachacuti was the empire of the Inca, the empire of the Incas before the Spanish Conquisition.
Yeah.
And what... So Pachacuti went to the Coracancha Temple of the Sun in Cuzco, the navel of the universe.
Right.
And he drew a diagram. And on that diagram, he drew the altar of the Sun Temple. So on that diagram of Pachacuti's is the copy of the altar. But remember, the altar was designed as a representation of the Inca's universe, the cosmovision. So the symbols on Pachacuti's diagram tell us so much about the structure of the Inca's cosmovision. For example, on the diagram, in the middle of the diagram, they lived in a three-level reality. They believed kind of what we do in the here and now, which was called Pachahana. They believed in Pachaque, which is our heaven, and Pachaurk, which is our hell. So Pachacuti's diagram has three levels, the hell, the here and now, and the heaven. But it also has a male and a female, who are Pachamama, the mother goddess, and creator god, the male. So what you've got is the male and the female. Then above them, you have the sun and the moon. Again, the sun representing the male, the moon representing the female. But in the center of the sun and moon, we have a large oval shape. Some people believe it represents Venus, but it has a cross on the top. It has the Southern Cross, four stars. It represents Viracocha. It represents the unperfect form, so the off circle before the moment of creation, which began with a circle. He's Viracocha, the oval, right there on Pachacuti's diagram. Pachacuti's diagram also, as you can see, matches identically to the geometry and the architecture of Inca Huasi.
Yeah.
So Pachacuti's diagram not only is a copy of the arrangement of the altar in the Coracancha Sun Temple, it is a representation of the entire Andean cosmovision, but as you'll see next week, also a diagram of the building of Inca Huasi.
Fascinating. Just amazing.
And that's where I'm going to link all three together, and it's quite something that Inca Huasi is virtually a 3D model of the main altar wall in the Coracancha Temple in Peru that Manco Inca built when he fled Peru, when he fled Cusco.
Who created that reproduction? Was it one of the local shaman?
The golden reproduction that you see in my blog features in the Cusco Temple of the Sun today about a meter high artifact in a glass box. It's a modern artist recreated it. There's several recreations around the town, but it's really the only piece of what you would call cosmic art that we have from the Inca time, because they were great for carving in stone and they were great for reshaping rivers and mountains, but they weren't great at art, at actual, you know, what we would call art. And they didn't have a written form of language. So the Pachacuti's diagram is super important.
It is. Let me ask you this, and we only have a few minutes left here. Is this NBC series only going to be aired, or has it already aired in the UK or in Europe?
No. So Legend Quest came out in 2012. It aired in, I think, 40 territories. It's available on iTunes, I believe.
Okay, so it already came out.
I should say this. I'm going to absolutely say this. The disclaimer, it's out there. You can get it. It's on. You'll get it on Hulu, these online TV stations. Legend Quest was one of the most important things I've done in my own life personally. As you said, 40 countries filming everything from the Holy Grail, the Ark of the Covenant, the Golden Sun Disc, Shambhala. We were in the Philippines. We're looking for big stuff.
Right.
But Sci-Fi ended up airing on Sci-Fi. So we got kind of like editors that worked on Sharknado and stuff like that. So it's quite a kind of breathless, high-octane show that was designed for a 19 to 29 audience. Do you know what I mean? So it's wonderful. You're going to see some of the most amazing locations in the world, but you need to hold your breath because it's fast-paced stuff. It's like Indiana Jones on crystal meth.
Yeah. I mean, I'd love to see the footage of you guys getting up into those high elevations in those Andes Mountains and some of the engineering you had to do to cross traverse rivers and stuff was amazing.
if you go to my last blog article, you can see I've got, you know, video footage in there of the hike to Incahuasi, of our horses, of us crossing these ravines, the landslides. It's all in there. Video.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Hey, the last question I have for you, you said something I thought was quite profound in that you said that you had been changed on a number of levels in your quest for this Inca gold disc. When you say change, what is it, a spiritual change that you've gone through? Obviously, you had physical changes that you weren't really happy about, but what is the changes that you've been through?
The changes, I'll tell you what directly happened is this. It's like I kind of, like we all do, we like to think we're open-minded people and we do have our beliefs, but we're open to other people's and everything else. It was when I arrived in Peru and got to Incahuasi and saw the extent of their worship to their creator and their love of mystery and the one who created, if you like. What it showed me was the world I'd been brought up in my Christian world, with its Christian denominations warring through a system of fear, the sword of God. We have a fear of our creator. It made me sad and made me, my whole mind opened up to, I am not open-minded. No matter what I try to think and achieve and learn in my life, I'm always going to be a product of a Western cosmology, religion and science-based. But when I saw what the Inca saw after 15 years of trying to taste it, it just made me see, it put me in perspective. I saw how small I was, how conditioned I was. It humbled me, Cliff. It was a humbling process where I just let go in so many ways. It destroyed my ego because I just don't give a flying hoot anymore about much.
Yeah.
Nothing's that serious. When you see the length people went to managing entire landscapes, with the faith in their beliefs, I'm quite a shallow sod, Cliff. We all are. And it really humbled me to see and made upset me as well. It truly upset me to see that we, from coming from a civilization like the Incas who could look at a mountain and figure out how to put farming terraces on that mountain so the flow of the mountain would not kill the fauna. Now we, to grow, to mass produce crops, we make species extinct. We've come from a balance with the universe to a state of disgust. And that's what my change was. It just made me see, and that's the word. The word is disgust for the way we live compared to the way they lived and the way we could live.
Yeah, more in unity with the planet is what you're saying.
Yeah, it can work with us. I truly believe that there's enough resources on planet Earth for the entirety of planet Earth. Our problems are getting it to the people. It's our human systems that let us down, and that's generally because of greed of a few. That didn't exist. The shamans and the rulers of the Incas, albeit, as I said, gold wasn't valuable to them. Gold was being pulled out of the rocks.
Yeah.
The rulers were on the same level as the farmers and the peasants. There was no social system. The Viracocha was the system, and everybody fell under his shadow. There was no social division like we have today. Therefore, no wars over religion and no wars over cosmological beliefs. There was true unity between man and landscape and cosmos.
Fascinating. Ashley, it's been a pleasure. We're going to have you come back and give us updates on your further exploration, especially as you post your blog.
Every week, 2 a week.
Yeah, so we'll check in with you again in the new year to see how you're progressing. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
It's been great, Cliff. Thanks so much. You've asked me some really good questions. I've done these a few times, and you sometimes get some really lame questions, and you've got to help the interviewer, but this has been just fantastic. You turned my key.
Okay, great. Thanks. So that was Ashley Cowie, and I let me spell his website. Out for you. It's Ashley Cowie. It's www.ashleycowie.com. And you can catch his the blogs, the first blog all the way to the fourth. And he's going to be continuing his posts right up until, I guess, into the new year, because he's got so much to talk about on this journey. Fascinating story. boy, I can't imagine being up in the, you know, thousands of feet in the mountains and not have your supply of carbohydrates. That must just have been nightmarish. So anyhow, I hope you enjoyed that. We are going to have Ashley on again in the new year to talk about this this quest and more specifics on these keek lines, these ley lines that he discovered, and specifically 328 sacred sites that lead from Cusco to various Inca locations. I'm just fascinated about that, and I'm really wondering. I believe the ancients had a knowledge of the earth energetics that we just do not appreciate. And so anyhow, look on my site also, earthancients.com. But on the Facebook page, I'll have more information on Ashley. So that was fun. As a reminder, our show next week, our first show of the new year, January 7th, we're going to bring in the foremost authority on crop circles, Michael Gleckman. And this was recorded a couple of weeks ago. I'm bringing on Gleckman for the simple reason that there's a series of crop circles that are just mind-blowing. And they've been testing the grounds, and there's all kinds of energetics. These sites, these crop circles are close to major known megalithic sites, and there's some correlation there that we'll learn about. So Michael Gleckman next week on Earth Ancients Radio. I hope you have a great Christmas and a happy new year, and we'll talk to you when the new year starts. Be well.
Here comes Santa Claus, here comes Santa Claus, right down Santa Claus Lane. Blixing and blixing and all his reindeers pulling on the reins. Bells are ringing, children singing, all is merry and bright. So hang your stockings and say your prayers, cause Santa Claus comes tonight. Here comes Santa Claus, here comes Santa Claus, right down Santa Claus Lane. He's got a bag that's filled with toys for boys and girls again. Hear those sleigh bells jingle, jangle, oh, what a beautiful sight. So jump in bed and cover your head, cause Santa Claus comes tonight.